The enchanted echo continued the message. He sent a message from across the sea, a boy lieutenant in the infantry. The stars looked down again upon the bay where he with frail canoe was wont to stray. The summer opened wide, an urn of joy that distance or no foeman can destroy. The little moments, the timeless tales, a softly brimming eye, a breath that fails. One day an understanding God shall see his children suffer and their tragedy, and send a cable to each warring soul to heal the sick and maimed, to make them whole. Oh, is this world a stage whereon we play, or just the prelude to a brighter day? The comet. Like a flash of inward vision, it bursts upon the eye. It seared across my consciousness that men shall never die. In travail of the 80 years, an episode gone by. For life is but a moment's pause, a transitory thing, the filaments of sunrise when a swallow stops to sing. And all the secret joys are gone on his uplifted wing. For men were ever humble when the last long parting nears, and few who dream that time is but an antidote for tears, till we shall find our vanished love across the striding years. Night fancies. When I'm closed in by utter dark, and walls and floors and ceilings go, a cold chill wind from outer space and distant planets seems to blow. While I'm suspended in mid-air, Salome of the Seven Veils dances for me. Scheherazade spins airy thin her wondrous tales. Tall knights and ladies, silken clad, dance minuet in stately walls. Geez, I better give that one again. Salome? Okay. Tall knights and ladies, silken clad, dance minuet in stately walls. Fantastic figures walk with masks. Forgotten kings forsake their vaults. Strange stars trail shadows down to drink sweet nectar from the Milky Way. Pale courtesans mark eyes with coal and sullenly make beauty clay. Weird Lorelei, like shapely seals, lure nightmare sailors to their doom. Pope Prester John sits on his throne. A single sunflower wakes to bloom. Then sleep blanks out that tapestry and isolates what thoughts reveal. But sleep, nor light, nor breaking dawn can make those dreams seem less than real. Premonition. A heap of gray, insentient dust within my hand, there, held in trust till it shall merge and be my own. Its substance mingled, breath and bone, impalpable, unbreathing quite, as uninspired as dynamite. The melting texture of my flesh, assuming contours clean and fresh of our old earth, that drinks the rain, and savors life, if life remain. Gray dust, I grant you furlough while I briefly live. Gray dust, I grant you furlough while I briefly live, and briefly smile. I'm at some rendezvous, you'll meet some added dust upon a street. Earth benediction. I thank you, Lord, for the gift of song, and careless hours as they pass along. The good dear things that I love so well, the sharp clear ring of a twilight bell, the priceless rest of an old armchair, and chants that the sweeping winds declare, the silver sheen of the rising moon, the sudden calm of a tranquil noon. For paths not long, nor hills too steep, I thank you, Lord, for the gift of sleep. And passing fair is the world to me, a pilgrim bound for the quiet sea. And that's the end of The Enchanted Echo. One more poem, which is quite recent. One of the few times when I have lapsed, I might call it, into the straight iambic rhythm, which doesn't run through the whole thing, but is nevertheless there. Joe Barr. In a gray town of 7 weekdays, during an eternal childhood, for I was so miserable sometimes at being me that I roamed lonely over the reeking town garbage dump, unable to talk to anyone, locked in my own body, captive of the motionless sun, in an eternal childhood. Old Joe went there too, happy as a young dog, pushing the garbage with a stick, grinning like a split orange, telling himself stories all day, the doors of his prison opening into rooms he couldn't remember, places he couldn't stay, the river providing a green sidewalk that bore his mind's feet lightly, his days like scraps of color, and the night birds always teaching him songs that because of his stutter he never learned to sing. I could have learned from Joe myself, but I never did. Not even when gangs of children followed him down the street, chanting, ah, 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 in mockery children have for idiots. In a town that looked like a hole, torn in blue clouds, where I made believe myself into a moonlit grasshopper and leaped the shadow's boundaries. I screwed that up. In a town that looked like a hole torn in blue clouds, where I made believe myself into a moonlit grasshopper and leaped the shadowed boundaries that bore my mind's feet lightly 40 years ago. In the gray town of memory, the garbage dump is a prison where people stand like stones. The birds are stuffed and mounted. A motionless sun still hangs there, where Joe is a scrap of crimson, and the sun at last goes down. God, it's different. Dormez-vous, a memoir of Malcolm Lowry. This appeared in Canada Month for September 1962. About 7 o'clock in the evening, the 2 bottles of whiskey we had brought with us were empty, tragically empty. Lowry and myself set out for Vancouver to get more, driving past the Indian graveyard on the Dollarton Highway, over the old Second Narrows Bridge, to a night liquor store near Main and Hastings. Instead of an abstemious single total of 26 ounces, Lowry bought 6, 1/2 dozen bottles of Bull's Gin. The sheer amplitude of alcoholic consumption which this implied overwhelmed me a little at that time. Outside the liquor store, Lowry turned to me, blue eyes glassy from gin. "There's a church near here with beautiful windows," he said. So we walked 3 blocks from the store, and indeed, there actually was a church. But a man of God in black garments was standing guard at the door. He explained to us that a wedding was about to take place inside, and we were not invited guests. I think, too, he had decided on first glance that we were both waterfront bums, for Lowry wore an old pair of corduroy pants and a black sweater, and I was dressed much the same. I explained to the priest, if such he was, that my friend thought the windows of his church were very beautiful and wanted to see them again. Lowry stood silently by while I talked. I tried to convey an impression of respectability and perfect sobriety, but it was difficult. Appearances were against us, and we were both frankly stoned. I had the virtuous feeling that I'd better do all the talking myself, for if Lowry spoke just once, a bottle of Bull's Gin was liable to pop out of his mouth and float high away over Vancouver's Skid Row before the horrified eyes of the priest. So I talked. A car drew up at the curb during my unpersuasive discourse. Some wedding guests got out. The priest hurried to greet them. While he did so, I was suddenly shocked to realize that Lowry had gone inside, while my harangue continued, simply walked in. I had been the unflattering red herring for his entrance, as now the wedding guests were for mine. Lowry knelt inside the church with 6 bottles of Bull's Gin in a brown paper bag on the seat beside him. I don't know if it was then or later that Coleridge's Ancient Mariner sprang into my mind, relating itself to this incident. A queer reversal of character, for Lowry resembled not at all the intense and talkative old seaman. But there he was, 6 bottles of gin slung around his neck instead of an albatross. silently praying to God for remission of his sins. However, he didn't call her one of the contemporary wedding guests to tell his tale. All the long involved story of Lowry's life went into books and poems instead. Perhaps white paper is the modern confessional, sometimes a more infuriating blank-faced listener than the original wedding guest. That happened in 1954, while two friends and myself were visiting Lowry and his wife at the now famous Driftwood House near Dollarton, B.C. The incident sticks in my mind, like something from a Freudian childhood. That young priest, is it possible to doubt his existence? Though what could be more real than six bottles of Bull's gin in a brown paper bag? Just the same, with very little effort, I can see Lowry dressed as a medieval seaman, watching fiercely while all the fancily attired wedding guests enter a strange church. Listen, he would say to them, once in a Mexican town called Cuanahoc, there was a consul. On a later occasion, I visited Lowry again, with a single friend this time. It seemed usual and completely normal that we drank Bull's gin, which sometimes took the place of tea and coffee in that household. Lowry went swimming, his red face and barrel chest bobbing around in the cold water like pieces of colored driftwood. Later, he and my friend sang songs outside the shack, while I copied some of Lowry's poems by lamplight. They were odd, doom-laden poems, and I had the sense that archaic death was leaning over Lowry's shoulder when he wrote them. No kraken shall depart till bade by name. No peace, but that must pay full toll to hell. And then the rough, tender voices floated in through the open door. Away, 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 you rolling river. Perhaps the albatross hung a little lighter around Lowry's neck. Everyone got enjoyably potted that evening, my friend particularly so. He had worked on coastal boats the previous summer. Now the time was approaching when he planned to go back to them. Lowry and he exchanged reminiscences of a sort, my friend telling of the white-painted tween-decks loneliness of coastal ships, and Lowry of its deep-sea equivalent. Eventually, my friend began to wallow in what I thought was a kind of histrionic self-pity, which increased as the gin vanished. He moaned and wailed about the necessity of undergoing a similar agony once again, departing the familiar, lovely, dingy city streets, and sailing off never to return, while all his friends wept copious tears. I couldn't feel that his panegyric was very genuine. He enjoyed it too much. But the performance almost sobered Lowry, and Marjorie, his wife, grew definitely alarmed. I have an idea she cursed us both in her heart. But it was a long evening. Lowry recited his Sestina in a cantina, his thespian voice bearing the full weight of archaic fear and horror. How the world is a great prison ruled by tossing moose heads and witch doctors in business suits. Then he told the story of how A.J.M. Smith, the eminent critic, jumped out the front window at high tide, fully clothed, apparently in a fit of euphoria, induced by salt water and Bull's gin. Lowry talked about the weird sorcerers of Central America, their seeming imperviousness to red-hot coals. How sailors all seemed to be part mystic and, falling silent, he stared in front of him, as if the room was completely empty. Perhaps he was thinking of the tossing moose heads that ruled the world, or the match spurt of a distant flame on its lone swan-like steel neck at the oil refinery across the inlet, of the ships that sailed forever, revisiting the old ports over and over again, with bells clanging out the time, but no one ever knowing what time it is or was. Time to go home. My friend is now extremely drunk. They invite us to stay the night, but he will not. Insists on his own little trundle bed. In fact, begs for it ardently. Lowry himself is also under the weather. Marjorie has to guide us up the half-mile forest path to the highway. She doesn't want to very much, but thinks we'll get lost if she doesn't. I have to support my friend, half carry him up the dark trail. His earlier enjoyable fantasies of horror suddenly become genuine, induce him completely in it. His earlier enjoyable fantasies of horror suddenly become genuine and overwhelm him completely in a self-induced hypnosis. Marjorie with a flashlight hurrying ahead of us, afraid of mountain lions. Myself with a drunken friend draped across my shoulders, laboring up the dark, steep trail. At the highway, before Marjorie turns to go back, she asks curiously, "Are you two homosexuals?" I don't know whether I laughed or not. Several months later, after the Lowrys had departed for Europe, I returned to the beach shack with my friend and a beautiful girl. We brought along a bottle of wine and drank it on the road, regaling the girl with tales of Lowry, about the savage mountain lions in that dark forest, striving to impress on her what a genius each one of us was. At the end of Lowry's dock, we poured what remained of the wine into the sea, accompanied by a suitable oration. All were impressed with the literary solemnity of the moment. But I think that Lowry himself never made such gestures. He was always himself, whoever that strange person may have been. 1962. I've just read Lowry's posthumous book, Hear Us, O Lord, with its recurring song of a ship's engines. And freighters are still moving out of Burrard Inlet toward the Lion's Gate, past the raised shack at the sea's edge. Throb of engines whispering among the trees near an overgrown path through the forest. Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques, dormez-vous, dormez-vous? Does the albatross hang lightly, Malcolm? Frère Jacques, dormez-vous, dormez-vous? Does the albatross hang lightly? Malcolm. The Iron Road, published in Canada Month, July 1963. This one starts with a verse. Riding the boxcars out of Winnipeg in a morning after rain so close to the violent sway of fields, it's like running and running, naked with summer in your mouth. Being a boy, scarcely a moment, and you hear the rumbling iron roadbed singing under the wheels at night. The door jerking open, mile after dusty mile, riding into Regina, with the dust storm crowding behind you, night and morning over the clicking rails. The year was 1937, and I was 17. I rode the freight trains to Vancouver, along with thousands of other Canadians during the Great Depression. In the hungry 30s, it seemed that half the population was on the move. The unemployed workmen of Toronto and Montreal and all the other big cities swarmed over the boxcars, moving west to the prairies, west to Vancouver, wherever there might be some hope of finding work. There were also the professional hobos, who always went in the opposite direction from where there was any rumor of employment. They lived in hobo jungles beside rivers, near the towns, never far away from the railway yards. There they lit campfires, cooked food, washed clothing, if it was absolutely necessary, and told tales of the steel highways over the fires at night. The towns where housewives always invited you inside for dinner, and you asked for a handout, and never handed you an axe while pointing sternly at the woodpile. The towns where you never had to work, there was always plenty of beer. But after a day or two in the jungle, they got restless again and boarded the train to anywhere. It was a dark night in early June when I caught my first freight train at the railway yards in Trenton, Ontario. It had chuffed in from the east an hour earlier and was about to pull out for Toronto. The yards were full of shunting switch engines, bustling back and forth in the night, red and green signal lights gleaming like the eyes of stationary cats. And every now and then, you heard a hoarse, impatient scream from the whistles of the westbound train. I'll never know how I had the nerve to board that train, for I was scared to death of it. I'd quit school a couple of years before. There was no work at all in Trenton, but that wasn't the reason I was heading west. The answer was boredom. I wanted adventure. That was the reason I crouched in some bushes beside the tracks, almost too nervous to breathe, wondering how I'd ever managed to climb out of that boxcar. Was it something like getting on a bicycle or a horse? And where were the railway police hiding? Suddenly, the westbound train made a peculiar toot-toot that signaled departure, a sound I've heard many times since. Hobos call it the highball. Then a great metallic crash came from the couplings. The train grunted away into the night. I broke from cover and ran alongside, grabbing at the steel ladder of a passing boxcar, and climbed up onto the roof, collapsing on the swaying catwalk, while all the vertebrae of the wriggling wooden serpent beneath me thundered west. A few days later, and miles from home, I received my first instructions from a professional bum about the proper method of boarding a moving train. A lean little man with a dark stubble of beard. He'd seen me swing onto a train by the rear ladder of a boxcar. "That's the way guys get killed," he said. "You gotta do it the right way." He spat tobacco on the boxcar floor and gestured. "I seen guys lose a leg or arm falling under them wheels. You always gotta go for the ladder at the front end of the car, never the one at the back end. If you miss your hold on the rear ladder, you fall between the cars and you're a gone goose. Always the front ladder. Remember that, kid." There were other famous bums who wrote their names and deeds on boxcar walls or the supports of water tanks with knife and pencil. Regina Sam Jones, Montana Slim, Midnight Frank. I've often wondered, why should a man call himself Midnight Frank? There also was the immortal Kilroy, who wrote, "Kilroy was here, the length and breadth of the continent." Farther west at Broadview, Saskatchewan, the Mounties had a reputation for being very tough on bums. The stories about their toughness alarmed me, so much I crawled down the trap door of a combine or threshing machine mounted on a flat car before going through town. I crouched in the darkness of that tin monster, nervously waiting to be discovered and hauled off to jail. I heard the police tramping around outside, making a tremendous racket. They didn't find me. When the train pulled out on its way west, I was the only illicit passenger left of the 60 or so who rode with me into Broadview. When I first started out for Vancouver, I had some money in my pockets, but it was soon spent. I had to forsake the aristocratic habit of eating in restaurants and join the other bums, knocking on doors to ask for handouts. It was embarrassing, but I got used to it. You nerved yourself, knocked on a door, and waited, wondering what might happen. The dignity of man was, of course, a lesser consideration than being hungry. You might get a sandwich from a housewife, perhaps even a full meal, a sit-down, we used to call it. But you might also be given an axe and directed to the woodpile. Or a man in shirt sleeves might come to the door and tell you to beat it, bum. It was all part of the game. You didn't really hold any grudges for a harsh reception. You just kept on trying. Sometimes you went to the bakery of whatever small town you happened to be passing through, asking the baker if he had any stale bread or buns. Most of the time you got something to eat. But occasionally there were long stretches on the train where it wasn't possible to ask for a handout. At such times, you stayed hungry. But I think my first sight of the mountains was worth all the hardships, waking early in the morning inside an empty boxcar to find myself walled round by rock. The mountains of the Crow's Nest Pass, it seemed to fall weightless upward into a sheer blue sky. And later, riding on top of a boxcar, gazing down into a lake, surrounded by forests stretching for miles and miles, cupped and cradled by the white peaks, and myself crawling round the side of a mountain like a fly on a sugar bowl. For the first time, I realized how big the country was, and naively, because I was only 17 years old, I felt a tremendous lift of exultation at the sight. How marvelous to be alive and ride a bareback train through such a country. And naively, 25 years later, I've not changed my mind. Vancouver was a sprawling, dingy, beautiful giant of a waterfront city, even in 1937. I walked down Water Street over the puddles and wet gray concrete in the early morning. An old Indian woman on an iron balcony called down for me to come on up and see her daughter, mentioning explicitly certain delights that could be expected. Rather prudishly, I declined. I spent the afternoon at a movie, paying 15 cents for the privilege of watching Dorothy Lamour disport herself in a sarong. But I'm not sure if the Indian girl wouldn't have been a better bargain. After the movie, I was seized with a realization of the immense distance I'd come from home. Originally, I'd meant to get a job fishing on a purse seiner at Vancouver, but the smelly old harbor depressed me. The Lion's Gate Bridge, stretching spider-like across First Narrows, seemed alien. The streets themselves were unfriendly, peopled by strangers. I was homesick. The same day I'd arrived, I slipped under the barrier at a level crossing and boarded a freight train moving east. And all the immense width of a continent was before me again, all the lakes and rivers and mountains, and the green country of childhood lay behind. Riding into the Crow's Nest Mountains with your first beard itching and 100 hungry guys fanning out through the shabby whistle stops for handouts, and even a sandwich for 200 miles, only the high mountains, knowing what it's like to be not quite a child anymore, and listening to the tough men talk of women and talk of the way things are in 1937.